This is an ABC podcast.
So far on the news today, I've seen stories on a global health pandemic, the looming climate apocalypse, the wrestle for the American presidency, and that's not even mentioning a national toilet paper crisis. No wonder a lot of us are feeling very anxious. But that feeling of a thumping heart and racing agitated thoughts, a lot of people feel that way all the time, even when the news is good. My guest on Conversations today is Dr. Mark Cross. You might remember Mark from the ABC TV series Changing Minds. The show followed patients in the mental health unit of Campbelltown Hospital in Western Sydney, where Mark was clinical director of psychiatry. What stands out about Mark in that series is his compassion, his commitment to his patients, and his strong South African accent. One of the disorders that Mark treats most often as a psychiatrist is anxiety, and it's something that he has more than a professional knowledge of. Anxiety is something that Mark himself has struggled with from a young age. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Sarah.
It has been a really distressing start to the decade. I mean, when things are bad in the world outside, does that make things worse for people who are already prone to suffer anxiety?
Well, it's certainly a trigger. But if I had to choose a moment in time to bring out a book on anxiety, this would be it, right?
So people are hungry.
Not that I want sort of fires, floods, plagues.
But I mean, are they related? Is it that people have this condition regardless of what's going on in the wider world or even in their own immediate circle? Or can something like an anxiety epidemic happen more generally because of the world we live in, because of changes in technology or threats with the environment? I mean, are more people suffering anxiety because of the way the world's changing?
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, in a way, you look at internal factors, right? And resilience. So those two, you've got protective and factors and things that make you vulnerable. So I have a vulnerability with my family history, for instance. So there's a genetic loading. And so if you look at refugees or immigrants, that new theory, medical theory is that, or the one that's current, is that the gene gets switched on in stressful situations. So, of course, outside stress makes the person who's more vulnerable to developing issues anyway then maybe present for the first time.
Why do you describe your anxiety as a red-eyed yeti? Do you actually see that yeti?
So I have a sleep disorder, and I've got the gene for narcolepsy, which runs in the family. So when I was four, I remember my grandmother coming to stay after my grandfather died, and my sister was in my room, and we had this Doberman, Genna, which is the Jewish word for hell, but there you go. And he was lying on my legs, and I woke up, and there was this red-eyed yeti standing next to my bed. So I have night terrors. So it's in the sort of space between waking up and then waking up completely, and it feels like an hallucination, and the thing is right there. And so that was the most, I remember it so distinctly, it is seared into my brain. And so I sort of externalize it a little bit, or anthropomorphize, or whatever the term is, my anxiety is that.
I've heard other people with anxiety do that, explain their anxiety like a guard dog, or sometimes like a worried friend, a security guard. Is that quite common for people to try to get a bit of distance between that emotion and the way they perceive it?
Yes, I think it's quite a useful way of looking at it in a way, although sometimes it's not, because it's part of us. So if you try and separate that part of you too much, say for instance stuff that you don't like about yourself, sexuality, all that sort of stuff, and you try and block it or get rid of it, then it's not useful. So you have to own it as part of yourself. So Sarah Wilson, in her book First We Make the Beast Beautiful, talks about that. I'm going to stop saying anthropomorphize now. Talks about that beast as part of her journey as well.
What happens to you physically, Mark, when that red-eyed yeti strikes? What's going on in your body?
It's interesting because, of course, anxiety can present in different ways. So some people can look anxious. I have that sort of deer-in-the-headlights anxiety, which isn't helpful when you say it in a conversation and your eyes are going left and you're thinking about other things and not concentrating and your husband's kicking you under the table, which often happens, and then the person or the people talking go, are we boring you? Which then precipitates a more obviously anxious response, and then I put my foot in my mouth or try and overcompensate. So that's a wonderful way my anxiety presents.
That happened to you when you were sitting your medical exams too. What happened with your final day of oral medical exams?
Oh God, that was awful. It was my pediatrics exam. So we have a week of clinical exams where it is absolutely decided whether you're going to be a doctor or not. And I'd made it to the Thursday. It was my last ever exam. Well, I hoped it was my last ever exam. And I was with pediatricians, who generally quite nice. I mean, they're not the worst
hopefully
examiners, I have to say. And I obviously withdrew more into myself. And the one examiner leaned across the table and said, would you rather be at the beach? Which, as I say, it was a stupid, redundant question, because who wouldn't rather be at the beach than a stupid exam? But, and then I started sweating more and managed to pass.
You looked anxious enough for them to understand that you were actually focused on what was going on.
Yes.
When there's that mask of deer in the headlights, inside is it all churn and chatter, or inside is there a deathly calm as well?
It is jelly, churn and chatter. But it's always good, because in a medical emergency, and actually someone asked me the question, do people around you with anxiety or issues make you more anxious? And actually, no, it calms me down, because that's a focus for me to deal with them. And that's always calmed me down. So in a medical emergency, and I've been involved in quite a lot in my time, I'm fine.
It gives you a clear role.
It gives me a focus and a way, and I suppose it's a mindful focus away from my own stuff.
Do you ever find yourself getting angry when anxiety strikes? You look such a genial, lovely fellow, Mark. I can't quite believe that you do, but I'll check.
I think various people are rolling their eyes listening to this, you know me, but it's, you know, I am, friend. But and again, it's not great for a white South African to get angry. The problem is I do. I have, and with so many of us who suffer from anxiety, we have this horrible self-stigma and negative self-talk all the time. So when I feel that I'm not performing well or doing something, then I get angry. I get angry with myself. The problem is that anger is projected onto people around me. And what they then see is this angry person and think, oh God, here we go. But actually, inside, I'm just having a wonderful... I'm going to stop saying wonderful. Actually, it's not wonderful at all. This horrible self-talk. And it's further distracting me from what I'm doing.
And if you had to give a figure to how often this red-eyed Yeti strikes you, is this something that happens weekly, daily? How often is this something you're grappling with?
Every day. Every day. There's certain parts of the day when it's worse, and I'm constantly thinking about it. But I'm an overthinker, right? And I think people with anxiety would relate to that. So I overthink everything. And at times it works better than others. And I was asked once, well, isn't there some benefit to having anxiety? And of course, if you look at from the outside in, I can be considered successful, and I feel blessed by that. So when I sometimes get anxious, it's useful, because then I'm on form.
Is that the kind of evolutionary role that anxiety has played for us as humans, do you think? A kind of a spur or a drive?
Yes, I do think that. And it's interesting, some neuroscientists who've come out as being anxious are looking at exactly this. So it's an evolutionary defense and something that saves us in a way. It's when you get to the point, though, when it becomes panic, then everything just tumbles.
How many other Australians suffer these kind of symptoms, suffer anxiety?
So in our national mental health surveys that happen periodically, we're looking at about 14%. That was a 2007 survey. More recent surveys, a bit higher. And if you look at anxiety and depression together, and then anxiety, so people with anxiety and depression, sometimes their anxiety doesn't get measured. People with complex mental health issues who have anxiety, and sometimes that's not measured as a separate entity from their other issues. And phobias aren't measured on those measures. So in fact, it's much more than actually measured.
Does it affect men and women equally?
No, women are more likely to have anxiety disorders. And, you know, linked back to your question earlier about societal issues, when you're talking about gender inequality, inequality generally in society, that's going to increase anxiety disorders.
And you mentioned that there are certain groups like refugee groups and I suppose other excluded groups like Indigenous Australians where there are good social reasons why people might have anxiety. But what about when anxiety is striking the people who from the outside look to be the most successful, you know, the privileged and the wealthy and the straight A students? Why is there such an anxiety epidemic among those kinds of people?
Well, I think it's linked to what you asked earlier. It is evolutionary, so people get anxious and that anxiety makes them strive to be better or for that perfection. Unfortunately, that's always linked as well. That doesn't help because you're constantly comparing yourself to this perfect avatar of yourself. And of course, nobody can do that. And that gives you drive. The drive, though, is self-defeating at times because you get to a certain point and you are successful but you don't want to accept that you are or you can't and you strive for more and you have to get off that merry-go-round. Otherwise, it leads to symptoms getting worse.
And what role do psychiatrists and other researchers think that genetics play in whether someone develops anxiety or not?
Well, there's a strong genetic component to all mood disorders, actually, and the more that we delve into genetics and the science behind things, the more we're finding that certainly it runs in families. There's certainly that to it. And the sort of current thinking I touched on earlier in terms of genetics is that you may be vulnerable to something. Doesn't mean you're going to get it. Because as an anxious parent, people are, you know, I thought one day, okay, am I going to pass it on to my child? It doesn't quite work like that. It's not a direct sort of link. And you mentioned earlier, so it's a tie-in with that stress and external stuff that can switch it on or bring it on.
Is there a family history in your case, Mark?
A very strong family history.
Where does that
come from? So my mother's side of the family mainly, my mother has anxiety. And my grandmother, her mother, had anxiety. But we've got a very strong family history of bipolar, dementia and alcohol in both sides of the family.
And was that acknowledged as you were growing up? Was that something that your mum identified about herself or talked about?
Never. We didn't discuss mental health issues. And in fact, everyone has their own journey. And I don't like speaking, she loves me and she's very proud of me. And she's more open now about things. So for instance, she had two cousins suicide. And I had a cousin suicide, and nothing was ever discussed about that. And so when I wrote the first book and I asked her about family history, and she was okay with it. But I think you'll find that in any family and in the Australian landscape as well, a lot of my patients, the older generation, just do not want to accept or talk about it.
What are your own earliest experiences of experiencing what you now know is anxiety?
I suppose when I was young, my father lost a lot of money and we had to move to his hometown to go and stay first in a hostel and then with my grandmother. And it was around 5 to 6 and I started a new school and I had developed a specific reading disorder, which is something that's quite incredible because, you know, I love reading now. But I had this disorder and the teacher was quite horrible to me about it. And I felt such shame and And I was bedwetting at the time as well. It wasn't a great time. So I remember that we talk about neurotic traits in childhood, bedwetting, thumb sucking, nail biting, that sort of stuff. I was a big nail biter too. And also understanding even then that I was different. There was something different in me in this very masculine, colonial upbringing where it was expected that you'd be a sporty person.
And where did that awareness of difference leave you feeling?
As I take a big sigh, I remember feeling dreadful. I remember feeling wrong and that I was letting my family down.
Would you try to edit your own behaviour as a child to fit in with what you understood was expected of a young South African boy?
I did, but also, and my father, I love my father to bits, and they didn't let me play the piano, for instance. So
why?
Because of the masculinity and underlying worry that I may be queer. And just as a little side thing, which is quite lovely, my father, when I was about 19, we went out for a drink. And he can deal with anyone as long as you can drink, right? So I took home a black lesbian friend of mine at university once. And they looked up. She walked in the room and he offered her a gin and tonic. It was fine. But as long as you drink, you can cope with anything. And he apologized for not letting me play the piano. Because of that. And I said, thanks, Dad. Now I'm a queer who can't play the piano.
He, you can laugh about it at a point where you're an adult, but back when you were a young kid and growing up, there was a time when you were playing dress-ups with your grandma's clothes and your dad came back home. What happened?
Yeah, that was a dreadful thing. And it was more... I've tried to explore this in my mind a little bit in terms of gender dysphoria and stuff. I don't have that. I never was anything but wanting to be a boy. But I loved dress up, and I used to drag my poor sister, pun intended, to play with me. And my grandmother was she was this very slim woman, very well dressed, and I used to act out elaborate fantasies. So it was more about acting, and I won the best actor at school, by the way. But
your dad loved that.
And it wasn't a career choice. And he came home unexpectedly, and it was dreadful. And it was I never did it again.
Dreadful in that you were shouted at or hit, or just that you knew you'd crossed a line?
It wasn't even that. It was the unspoken stuff. It was the look on his face and then the muted discussion behind closed doors when my mother got home from work. And I knew that I'd transgressed in some dreadful way, and I never did it again. And it was also further that I used to love cooking. But in standard four, so what, that's about grade six, handed in a recipe for a chocolate cake that I used to make, and I was marked down, and the teacher then commented that boys don't bake.
So it was very clear culturally what was okay for a boy and what wasn't, and you're feeling this disconnect from that. At what age, Mark, were you able to acknowledge to yourself that you were gay?
About 12 or 13, I was aware. I didn't want to acknowledge. Acknowledge is such a difficult term to answer, actually. But to myself, even, I still hid it. I still didn't want to deal with it.
Tell me about the letter you wrote to Katharine Hepburn when you were 13.
I wrote to David Bowie as well. But, yes.
I wrote what to great godparents, David Bowie and Katharine Hepburn, every queer child's fantasy.
It was around the time of my confirmation. It was a bit of a weird time. And I had this weird guy come to my house, and he kept on touching my knee. But anyway, and talking to me about God and such things. And I just thought, this life is not for me. I want to be somewhere else. So I wrote to Katharine Hepburn asking her to adopt me. My poor parents, things that I've done. Anyway, and she wrote back a little postcard, and I think I've got it in a box at home. Oh. Unfortunately, I cannot. in her very loopy handwriting. And okay, and she has this wonderful middle name, and I can't remember it now. So at least she acknowledged that she received my beautiful letter.
What about David Bowie? Did he write back?
No, he didn't write back.
So this is something that you're aware of in yourself and aware of that this in wider South Africa is not going to be looked on kindly. What about when you entered training to be a doctor? How was homosexuality talked about in your medical training?
Well, if it was talked about at all, it was with horrible connotation. So not only was it a criminal offence in South Africa at the time, but it was also medical mental illness. So we followed the ICD, International Classification of Diseases in South Africa, so that's the World Health Organization classification as opposed to the DSM from America. And homosexuality was only removed as a medical illness in 1990, when the year I graduated.
You volunteered at an HIV service while you were in South Africa. What stories did you hear from men there that have stayed with you?
Yeah, I promise I wasn't going to cry because
we encourage crying.
You know, as a psychiatrist, I don't like showing emotions.
You're not here as a psychiatrist. You're here as my guest, and tears are welcome.
So I was quite young, and again, still dealing with my own sexuality that I wasn't properly out with yet. It's taken, you know, it's always such a journey. It's never one point in time. But anyway, I started seeing this lovely man who was HIV positive. And he'd got his diagnosis after bashing gay people. So he used to go, what was the lovely term at the time, queer bashing. And one could argue that, you know, that's God's punishment or whatever. But the more and of course it's difficult as a therapist or something, you don't judge, you can't judge. I can't see people who sexually abuse kids, but that's everything else, you know, I try not to judge. And I developed a lovely relationship with him. And of course I was dealing with my own stuff, and it's in a very non-structured, I wasn't supervised, and I saw him quite often. And then he finally came out the first time ever to me that he was gay. And that was pretty amazing. And then he died after working in the field for a year or so. So I did cry then, I have to say.
Did your parents have any idea what was going on with you as a teenager and a young man?
They say not now, but actually I remember a period. And memories are so funny. My mother sometimes goes, Mark, you make stuff up. And my mother doesn't drink, but every now and then she has a half a glass of champagne, and then she becomes this raconteur, usually at my expense, and my friends love it, so they're always ploughing her with some champagne because she just relaxes. It's so wonderful seeing her just relaxed, and it doesn't happen often. She's always so uptight. But I remember coming back from university in my first or second year on holiday, and there was a You magazine or something, How to Tell If Your Son is Homosexual article. A very helpful magazine. It had something to do with they can't whistle and the way you put your hands on your hips. But anyway, I kid you not. And she'd laid it out on the table but didn't talk about it. And then when I left South Africa, so I was 26, and I'd already told my sister I was gay, and we had this family dinner. And my father, who calls me Pal or Joe when he's really loving towards me, I was going on about things a bit, and as I usually do. And he stood up, and he came to me, kissed me. He's very tactile, my father, on my head, and hugged me. He said, if you're trying to tell us you're gay, Pal. And I went, no, I'm just going to therapy. And my sister went, oh, for F's sake, and then left the table because...
So he was saying it's okay for you,
yes,
to tell us.
Yes, I know,
us.
But I wasn't even then I wasn't prepared to take up the signal or the offer. It was just so shaming.
When you look back over that period of your life, I mean, how big a part do you think your sexuality and feeling had to hide that was a part of anxiety developing in the way it did for you?
I think it's a majority of it, I have to say. I haven't really analysed it. Oh, that's a lie. I analyse everything, but I haven't analysed it completely. But I would say it's a huge... And it's not so much sexuality. It's others' perceptions of the external threat to you as a person who's gay. So, you know, I don't think, otherwise I would have put that as an internal cause of anxiety. Being gay or LGBT or anything doesn't make you anxious. It's others.
Has it been an issue with your medical colleagues in more recent years, your sexuality?
So the nice thing is I've always been open to my colleagues, and also thinking about how I work. If somebody asks me directly, and it's only my women, my female patients with mania who ever ask me directly, I've got this thing, and I've always said yes. I can't lie about myself, but in my world, it's not something, you don't bring it up, right? So being open is one thing, but you don't. It has to be done in context. So I've been very open with my colleagues. I made that decision when I went to England. I mean, I went to England to find myself and to grow and to be a gay person. And I did.
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Mark, describing your training as a doctor, your realisation about your identity as a gay man, then we throw in this identity of being a psychiatrist. So there's gay Mark, anxious Mark, and psychiatrist Mark. How do they fit together? Because is the expectation that doctors, particularly psychiatrists, you're meant to have it all together. You're meant to be the ones that we go to for help. You're supposed to be sorted out.
Well, in my training, it was very clear that we should be stiff upper lip, and there should be a very clear distinction between us and the patient. So us and them, which I haven't really followed all my time. But also, there's some advantages to getting older, right? There has to be. And one of them is I feel that I can be more open now. Also, I've moved to private practice for various reasons, including people can then choose to come and see me. So I don't force myself onto anybody. For instance, but it is a big thing in our world. We're not supposed to share of each other.
Is that the,
of ourselves, sorry.
Is that the case even among the medical profession? I mean, how open are doctors with one another about mental issues they might be facing themselves?
Oh, no, we don't do it very well in health at all, doctors and nurses, and we make the worst patients too. But
that's such a terrible irony, given that the advice is always being given, talk about it, be open about it, but doctors themselves find that hard.
You know, I gave a speech last year at the media launch for the Australian Mental Health Prize, and I was asked, because of the crisis in the public system, and as a senior person who's won all these awards and being so open, and why I left the public service. And I did. I said, look, I was burnt out and there were various reasons. And I talked about my anxiety. And a professor of psychiatry came up to me afterwards and said, Mark, that was very brave. So on one level, that's great. But on one level, I was quite upset by that because I thought, well, if we can't talk about ourselves openly, how are we supposed to exhort others to do so? That's hypocrisy, and I don't like that.
The idea that you're being brave suggests that it's a dangerous thing to do, doesn't it?
Yes, so it's a double-edged sword. You go, well, oh, you're brave. Why don't you fall on your sword because it's going to mean a political suicide?
Can there be... There's personal and shame, I suppose, and personal stigma if doctors acknowledge their own mental health conditions, but are there also professional consequences? Like if a doctor acknowledges that he or she is suffering anxiety, depression, bipolar, what consequences might there be for them professionally?
Yeah, so in terms of professional stuff, not political, there's a real fear that if you come out with anything, you won't be able to practice anymore. And there's this horrible thing, mandatory reporting, that is not done properly. And people don't get it right. And the perception, and you're right, anxiety is a fear and perception. The anxiety is far greater than the actuality of it, but doctors fear, and nurses, that if they go and seek professional help, they can somehow be reported, which of course is a nonsense because you have to show significant harm to the public in order to be reported. Our system doesn't work properly because the narcissists and the psychopaths amongst us, who either sexually abuse their patients or worse, don't get caught up in this net.
They don't self-identify, of course not.
No, so people who identify and go, okay, I'm going to go seek help, we still have a long way to go, put it that way.
What has been most helpful for you personally in managing this red-eyed Yeti of yours?
I think the one thing is having people who love you, you know, having a family and friends and support networks. I think that's really, really important. I couldn't do this alone. In terms of other things that I try and utilize, and sometimes not so well, I'm trying to meditate and do yoga now, finally. I finally accepted that yoga is actually quite useful. So exercise, diet, and sleep are my holy mantras.
All of these very old-fashioned, boring things, hey? These aren't cutting-edge new therapies or technologies. Sleep, exercise, diet, meditation.
I love the way, you know, we talk about the old wives, right? So the old wives knew what they were talking about. I don't know where that term comes from, but they certainly know what they're talking about.
Is there almost the fact that you're a psychiatrist who is used to giving this advice to other people, is it sometimes a bit harder almost for you to take yourself?
You're very perceptive, I have to say, Sarah. I'm useless at taking my own advice. And, you know, John will come and say, well, why don't you come and spread some, you know, optimism and positivity at home that you share with all your patients and, you know, work on things. So we are dreadful at taking advice or our own advice. And, of course, that stems to the self-stigma thing again and the negative self-talk.
What about other techniques like medication or therapy? Have either of those been useful for you?
I've tried various medications and I get side effects, I must say. And of course, I prescribe these things. I once took a very minute dose of an old antidepressant called prothioidin, which is Dothep, and I got dried mouth and blurred vision and I couldn't pee properly. And that was, you know, I prescribed like 4-10 times that amount to people. And some people, you know, adjust. It's an individual variation. Sometimes medication is useful. I always look at medication as part of a holistic sort of approach. And people take medication and they find it useful. I don't like people who go, you know, you don't need medication. People on medication shouldn't be made to feel ashamed that they're on medication. And there's a real reason why they're on it. And it's useful.
Are there particular medications that target anxiety? Are there good medications specifically to treat anxiety?
We still have a long way to go with anxiety particularly because the main group of medications for anxiety are the benzodiazepines, so the Valium-type drugs. And they've got some very negative press and people get confused by that.
There's concerns around addiction with those drugs, isn't there?
There's concerns around addiction and if you're taking too many over too long a period, you actually start getting dependent on them. They're all those issues. But if I can just give you one little story, this is a problem. I have a patient, a male executive in his 40s. He had a panic attack like 25 years ago, married with a son. He's married to an African woman whose father died, and she went to Africa for the funeral and took their son with her. And that precipitated a little bit of anxiety. But he was on the plane to Melbourne for a work conference with his work colleagues, developed a panic attack, couldn't get rid of it, walked around Melbourne that night, couldn't sleep, walked around Melbourne the next day, and eventually he went to a hospital, emergency department, and he was told, we don't admit people for anxiety. And because he looked so disheveled, he felt that they thought he was a druggie. I hate that term, but it's a term he used. And they wouldn't give him Valium because they obviously it was considered that he was seeking it. Eventually got home, went to see his GP who was off, saw two other GPs who were proudly non-benzodiazepine prescribing. I mean, as a doctor, you have to think about things and use your intelligence and common sense. Eventually, his counselor from work had to call a GP and say, this man needs medication. You know, sometimes it's useful. So by the time I saw him, he obviously was absolute anxious wreck. And he came in And after having Valium once, he actually felt much better because he was prescribed Seroquel, which is an antipsychotic mood stabilizer, but with its own issues.
And would that have been, say, in that patient's case, something that he would have needed to keep taking regularly? Or is it like controlling a particular episode and then life balances itself out again?
So what's useful with this medication is that it absolutely stops an episode. So it's taken as required. It's not useful as a long-term ongoing medication. So if it's used properly, as in his case, it absolutely took his panic away. And then we looked at other issues. And now he has made, maybe in the last month, taken it once.
Wow. So people, it's not like antidepressants where people are put on a regular dose that they have to take day in, day out. This anti-anxiety medication might be more targeted to when person's having an experience of
yes.
the condition.
Yes, sorry. So when people, so a couple of my patients who work, they take a half a tablet before they have to do a presentation, or social anxiety. Of course, there's a big warning here. You can't drink once you've taken it. And of course, with social anxiety, which I have, alcohol has not been my friend when I'm glugging, trying to calm myself down at a function.
It's such a common drug to use, though, isn't it? I mean, you're mentioning with your mum, half glass of champagne and she relaxes. Like, that's a very fine line for people to know where to get right, where that helps with social anxiety and where it can create huge problems, I'm guessing, for anxious people.
Well, I suppose you just hit the nail on the head of any medication. So alcohol is a drug. Any drug, including those prescribed and not prescribed, have a sort of use. Otherwise, why would we take them, right? And they have a positive effect. But of course, as with anything, it also has a negative effect. And by and large, that's dosing. So alcohol, yeah, one or two, fine, as long as you can stop there and be mindful about how you're using it. And mindfulness is a wonderful term, by the way. It underpins anything, modern day therapy and how we look at things. If you're mindful about how you drink, you're mindful about how you take medication and use it properly, the main thing is you want to feel in control. It's all about control. And if you feel better in control, then you're able to then interact with your surroundings better.
There is some research, isn't there, into drugs which are currently illegal, like psychedelics and the treatment of anxiety. How does that fit in with feeling in control? Because I'm imagining if you're tripping out on something, you're not feeling so in control.
No, but if it's interesting. MDMA, so ecstasy, has been approved by the FDA in America since 2015 for use in PTSD. So in PTSD, so post-traumatic stress disorder, and the dreadful thing is trauma underpins so much. It just is so pervasive and so dreadful, and it causes so many problems. Anyway, so with trauma, you have to, in order to get better, experience or re-experience or talk about the trauma. And so what MDMA does, and of course it's all in California, right, these trials, unfortunately the therapist doesn't take MDMA. It's an 8-hour session. The person takes MDMA, and they've done this in war vets. I've got a couple of war vets I see, and they go, come on, doc, let's go. I'm sorry, I can't prescribe it now, thank you. So it's an 8-hour session, music, lounge chair, towel, and they talk about all this horrible stuff while their affect, so the way they're feeling, whatever, is warm and fuzzy due to the ecstasy. Then it's treatment as usual for 3 weeks, then another session, then treatment as usual, and another session, and they show positive brain changes.
Wow, so it's the
incredible.
Results of that are quite positive so far.
I think from this, I'm going, oh my God, I'm probably going to create a storm in Australia. But it's amazing. And also, you know, once it's researched properly, so the University of Sheffield or Leeds, I think, and they're looking at MDMA for alcohol craving. We haven't got drugs right for alcohol craving yet. So there's been quite a lot of research, plus ketamine for chronic depression or treatment-resistant symptoms, and psilocybin, which is a part of the magic mushroom for conditions. It's really interesting.
It's interesting that example of the PTSD sufferers taking MDMA in a session where they're also talking. So what role does talk therapy have? Have you found that to be effective without the MDMA component?
Yes, just for the record, I haven't taken MDMA and gone to therapy. Look, and I resist, a lot of us do. I mean, I resisted therapy for years.
Why?
Oh, you know, for various reasons and not wanting to acknowledge and not wanting to talk. We all have our own ways of dealing with things, and we all develop coping strategies, and hey, some aren't good and some are more useful. And again, as you age and hopefully come to a realization that it's time to seek help, and I'm sure you know, people ask, when should you seek help? Everyone has their own journey, and often people will seek help later in life when they finally come to the realization or the acknowledgement, hey, I think it's time that I did something about this, and listen to all my family members who go, really, you should go and get some help. So I have felt talking therapy of great use.
In what way? How is it useful dealing with anxious thoughts or that racing heart or the palpitations that people get when they're feeling anxious?
So the different types of therapy, the main ones for anxiety are the modern focus ones like cognitive behavioral therapy. And I mentioned mindfulness earlier. All mindfulness actually is, it means that you concentrate on being in the present and what you're doing. And that's incredibly helpful for racing thoughts and horrible physical stuff when you actually then take the time to just breathe, because it is also about focusing on breathing and focusing on something that's positive. And that's really helpful. But the sort of therapy that I've trained in as well and underwent earlier on is a sort of more psychodynamic psychotherapy, which the dynamics that focus on the dynamics of your relationships with reflection on your past relationships and how you develop as a person. And that's a more longer term therapy. And I think that I found that very helpful in understanding myself.
Do you notice among your own patients that anxiety is something people can be free of? Or is it more something that is an ongoing condition that people learn the best way that they can live with or manage?
It's a very difficult thing that, you know, I've been asked, can you overcome anxiety? And I'm always trying to be measured in my response about that. It depends on the cause of anxiety. So if you're in a situation because of your skin color and you're getting stress and anxiety linked to that, and that goes away and you feel equal and loved and everything's fine, then major cause of your anxiety has gone, right? Which is why marriage equality, all those things are so important in our society when you're looking at anxiety. Thyroid, for instance, thyroid is a potent issue with mood. And if you've got too much thyroid hormone, you can feel that you're having panic all the time. You treat the thyroid and your panic goes away. So that's great. And it's wonderful when that happens. But by and large, people such as myself and those I treat have had anxiety for a very long time. And it's almost part of our personalities in a way, and the way that we respond to things. But we can learn to manage it as I have and still continue to do so. You can manage it well, acknowledge it. And part of that is the self-stigma that keeps it going, because it's not a weakness. You can actually, it's part of you. Almost embrace it. And that's why, you know, my red ideate, I need to hug it.
You need to develop a sort of a range of soft toys to go with this book,
absolutely.
Mark. You know, the red-eyed Yeti plushie.
Okay, yeah. I shouldn't say absolutely. That was my sons might like that, but you know, it's absolutely. That's a really nice way of looking at it.
To have a kindness towards that.
Kindness and compassion. I mean, that underpins everything that I do. And you need to be kind and compassionate to yourself. And one of my patients, they give me a bit of talk back, you know, when I say to them, because that's a big theme in most of my sessions. Please be kind and compassionate to yourself.
It can be exhausting, though, to be partnered with or work with or parent someone who's suffering anxiety. I can hear a big sigh there. Have you had that pointed out to you?
I don't know what you mean, Sarah.
But it can. I mean, talk about that, because part of the focus is on, rightly, on the person who's suffering, but it demands a lot of the other people in that sufferer's life.
It does, but this is where the horrible double-edged sword comes, because then you feel even worse about yourself, because you can see the effect you're having on your family members. Because remember, with anxiety, on one level, you know that it's a nonsense, these horrible, fearful thoughts. So when I'm lying in bed and I hear the possums on my roof, I know I'm not getting attacked by the SAS or whatever. I know that, but I still can't get to sleep. And then you start developing these horrible ruminating self-recriminations about what you're thinking, which again doesn't help. And then you're constantly seeking reassurance, and your partner and your friends or your family, your people around you finally go, oh, for God's sake, take a chill pill, which they don't mean. They don't mean at all, because that's not very helpful, saying that to anybody who's going through
this. So what have you found works in your relationship? How do you manage both looking after what you need and also understanding that your partner isn't your therapist? How do you find that balance?
By finding my own therapist, that's a useful thing. So always, always seek help. And I think, and then you can separate, you've got to try and separate these things as best you can, compartmentalize. That's helpful, actually. You compartmentalize things. You put on a facade for work, right? So we're used to doing these things in our life. You just have to do a little bit more when you have anxiety. And then you go talk to someone, make sure that you utilize positive steps like the exercise, sleep, diet, all those things, and still have some fun.
Still have some fun. You're a dad as well, Mark. How has that ramped up your anxiety? I mean, all of us who are parents are fearful to a degree. What is it like being an anxious person with children?
You know, it's the most amazing thing. And as a gay man, I never thought I'd be a father. So it's the most amazing. It's incredible. And it's really helped me. My sons are 9 and 7 now. We're very tactile and they love hugging. And when I get angry or anxious, they can pick it up in a nice way. And they're the two on this planet who can deal with me the best. And obviously I respond to that. So it's a wonderful thing having unconditional love and support. And just a hug sometimes, and then I go, oh, wow, okay, I feel calmer now. It's quite incredible.
Do you talk openly with them about your own anxiety?
Well, we watched a TV clip that I was on the other day, and they know that they get anxious, and my younger one turned to me and said, oh, I didn't know you have anxiety like that. So it's always useful talking. So when you talk about kids generally, don't hide things. You know that lovely old saying my grandmother used to use, I'll tell you when you're 21, isn't a very useful way of dealing with issues with kids. And the more open you are, without putting onto them, obviously, the better. I think if you talk about these things and allow them to express themselves, so of course they want to express themselves. And of course they have anxiety as a child. As I said, most of the people that I've spoken to all have anxiety symptoms from 5, 6, 7.
If a parent is seeing those symptoms in their child or a teacher seeing symptoms, what should they do?
Well, often the problem, though, is the symptoms are acting out behaviour or attention seeking, that it's labelled as. Any behaviour that a young child develops is a communication. And yes, you have to deal with the behavior at the time, but then you have to deal with it as a communication tool and debrief and work it out with that child. There are not many children who just start acting out in class without a reason. And you have to then think about the reason.
And is it then taking that child to a GP or seeking a psychologist or speaking with them? And what should a parent who finds himself concerned about that do you think?
Well, I think teachers are so helpful in this situation, and hopefully the parents are open to a discussion. So I think that's a good place to start. And most schools, you'll have some counsellors. And I've come across some amazing school counsellors in my career. That's the place to start. It's where you are in your community or family. And then, of course, it's also useful sometimes having a therapist. But the important thing is, Sarah, so, you know, we forget it's a system. And what's often not a good way forward is to focus too much on the individual. So you don't want to focus too much on the child. You look at things around them and people around them and involve them in a holistic approach to talking the situation through.
Over the many years now, Mark, that you've been working as a psychiatrist and also working on your own mental health, what's your understanding of the boundaries between well and unwell or sane and mad? How do you think of that? Is it a continuum or are they very clear categories?
Again, you know, going through my head are so many things because, you know, people who have mental health issues sometimes don't like that continuum. Oh, everyone has something. No, there's an illness. So you have a clearly defined mental health issue. But in fact, in terms, when we're talking about anxiety, it's a little bit more grey at times. And so in my view, and in my way of looking at the world, I love grey. I don't like black or white. I don't find that's very helpful most of the time in my thinking. I don't like binary thinking. It's not often useful. And they're different shades in between that you can operate in.
How has it been for you writing this book, writing out about anxiety? What's it been like since it's been published?
Well, luckily people like you say that it's not such a bad thing. So, you know, because you constantly
I think I was more positive in what I said, Mark. I didn't say it's not a bad thing. I said it's a great thing.
You know, you talk about, actually talking about earlier when you asked, humour. I use humour a lot, but sometimes actually even then it can be too self-deprecating or too sharp, and you've got to watch out when you use defences like that. But it's been amazing, and people are being so nice about it, and it's fine. It's like a weight off my shoulders, I have to say, because you do put your head up above the parapet and you expect people to shoot you down.
Instead, we say thank you so much for the book and for being my guest on Conversations. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for being so nice to me.
My guest on Conversations today is Dr. Mark Cross. Mark's book is simply called Anxiety. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.